Okay, here we go. Hanukkah, Tav Shin Ayin Beis, second day of Hanukkah, and Parshas Miketz. Our subject is the Hanukkah dreams. Paro's dreams were Hanukkah dreams, right? Let's go through the two dreams carefully, and let's try to think about a few things. Number one, how are they Hanukkah dreams? Number two, what was the fear factor here in these dreams for Paro? Obviously, if these are the dreams that nobody could answer, and that Yosef provided a solution to, an explanation to, and good advice about, and this catapulted Yosef into fame, and this led to Klal Yisrael coming down to Mitzrayim to start the Gullus, but in a pleasant, honorable way. And this led to the Jewish people remaining in the Gullus, and this led to Yetzias Mitzrayim, which led to a great revelation of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the world. Obviously, the process is starting here. Well, you know, there's always the root reasons which even go back further, but we're certainly seeing Yosef and his dialogue, his conversation with Paro, and his explanation of the dreams as very, very much the starting point of ultimately what the world would come to learn about the concept of a single God who controls all of nature. As you know, the Makos were a demonstration that each of the God concepts that the Egyptians believed in, every force of nature that they trusted in to govern their lives, was one by one demolished, so to speak, shown to be powerless through the process of the Makos, ultimately with Yetzias Mitzrayim and the splitting of the sea. By the way, just a side point. The reason HaKadosh Baruch Hu ultimately drowned the Egyptians with the Yam Suf, one of the reasons, is because they had a hierarchy of gods. The 10 most powerful gods were the gods that were addressed in the Makos. The Nile was a god, the root of their sustenance, the dirt, the earth was a god, the sun, the moon were gods, all these type of things. But the god of all the gods, as there always was in ancient culture, a supreme god. By the Greeks, it was Zeus, and the Romans had Jupiter. But back in the day, everybody had their main god. It was usually the sun god or the rain god. In Egypt, it was the water god. It was called Baal. Say, like in Canaan, there was a Baal. It was called Baal Tzifon. And the Baal Tzifon had a shrine on the Yam Suf. That made sense. So when HaKadosh Baruch Hu brought Klal Yisrael, what looked like wandering and, you know, and losing their way till they ended up in front of the shrine of Baal Tzifon there to drown the Egyptians, that was the ultimate, you know, knife, you know, the turn of the knife, where even though you might have held on to one last ray of hope that the minor gods were not as powerful as Yud-Kei Vav-Kei, but we still have our main god, Baal Tzifon, right there in front of Baal Tzifon, as he stood by helplessly, all the Egyptians were drowned in his ocean, in his sea, whatever it was, in the Yam over there. So this was, no question about it, the Makos were a demonstration, as it says, Leman Yedu Mitzrayim. Hashem kept telling Moshe to tell Paro that he's going to do these miracles so Mitzrayim will know that there's only one God of all of heaven and all of earth. But this process starts with Yosef. The God of the Paro of Yetzias Mitzrayim was not a moral and ethical or philosophical Paro, but this Paro that Yosef's dealing with, close to 200 years, less than 200 years earlier, okay, was of a different nature. And this Paro was a thinker. And that's why the dreams were so disturbing. And when Yosef explains the dreams, what's really happening here is Yosef is beginning to introduce Mitzrayim by virtue of that, the whole world, to the ideas that would be ultimately really revealed by Yetzias Mitzrayim. But he's explaining to Paro through the dreams and the interpretation how we, the Jewish people, so radically differ in our view of the world than the Egyptians. And this is so transformative to Paro in his mind. And he sees the intelligence and the truth of what Yosef is saying, and he elevates Yosef. So what's happening here? These dreams are very important. First, we have to understand the symbolism of the dream. We're going to understand what it meant to Paro and how it is related to Hanukkah. So let's carefully go through the dreams, okay? There's a few things that are obviously very symbolic in the dreams. So at the beginning of Parshas Miketz, so he's Paro dreams. Vihine, and behold, Omed al Hayar. That's point number one. He's standing on the banks of the river. He's not in the river. He's on top of the river. Maybe he's hovering over the river in his dream. Maybe he's standing on the side of the river. But one thing's clear, he's not in the river. He's above the river. Okay? Think about what river meant, the concept of a river, and don't go into Torah and Mayim Chayim, because that's a well. That symbolism is a well, not a river. So well brings up from the depths, right? But this is a river. Think about the symbolism of a river in the ancient mind. He's standing on the river, and from the river, out of the river, arise seven cows that are beautiful and healthy. So you have seven. You know what that is. Nature, Teva. You have cows. You know what that is. They plow. That's the land. That's food. That's agriculture. And they look beautiful. And they come out of the river, and after them, of course, and they're grazing on the side of the river. Afterwards, seven more cows come out of the river, but they are terrible looking and very gaunt. And for a while, they stand next to Vatamodna, Eitzel Haparos Asfaser. They stand next to the other cows on the banks of the river. They are, you know, there's a equality there. There's a, you know, a sense of balance of seven beautiful cows and seven terrible looking cows. And then, as you know what happens, the bad looking cows eat up the beautiful cows, and Paro wakes up. Then he has a very similar dream, and that dream is about sheaves of wheat, seven sheaves all coming out of one central stalk. Okay, what is the symbolism? In the first dream for Hanukkah, the skinny, bad looking cows, the gaunt ones, are the ones that seem to be weak. Right? What do? They have the power to overcome, defeat the big, beautiful, powerful. That's clearly what? Rabim Biyad Ma'atim. And the second dream, that's the nace we mentioned in Al-Hanisim. And the second dream is obviously the menorah. Seven sheaths coming out of a central stalk. And that's the dream, that's the nace we mentioned that's the nace that we commemorate with the menorah. We have Al-Hanisim on the war, which mentions the menorah, and then we have the menorah. But the Al-Nisim is basically about the war. The Arabim biyad ma'atim and Giborim biyad chalashim. That's for sure part of Hanukkah, and we will get to Hanukkah later on. But now, for Paro, this doesn't sound like a nightmare, right? It's not that terrifying. What disturbed him so much? So he calls in his wise men, and they say, you're going to have six daughters, and they're going to die. You're going to capture six cities, and they're going to be, then you're going to lose them, and this is not good enough for him. Until Yosef comes. Now, just a point here, a side point. Yosef is not, as we talked about, a not a Navi, correct? Yosef is a Chacham, remember this? Chacham Adif Mi Navi. How does Yosef know through Chochmah that this is not talking about objects like cities or people like daughters? This is speaking about time. Rabbi David Foreman has an ingenious shiur on this subject. You can try to Google it. Yeah, how does he know? Because he says that Yosef sees in here, because Hashem has to give him the tools, the information to, from his own life experience, to kind of figure out what's happening here. In his life, there was also the beautiful, same words, Yefos Mare, right? And seven, what was that? It was Rachel, 7 years. Yaakov worked 7 years. Then there was Leah, who Einah, her eyes were Rakos, these are Dakos. Right? And that's seven. And he figures out this is years. But what's interesting is that the fact that these are years is fundamental, because there's no question that that is exactly what is bothering Paro with the concept of time. In the ancient world, the river of time, river symbolizes the flowing, ongoing current that carries you along, and that's time, the life cycle. Okay, till today, you want to know where the young generation is introduced to it? In The Lion King, the cycle of life. Okay, all of these ideas that there is a natural cycle of life, there are seasons, there are different forces at work in the different seasons. There's the planting time, the growing time, and the harvesting time. There's the birth and the death. There's disease and there's recovery. There are cycles of life, and time carries you through these cycles. And when you're born, you are subject to the forces of nature, primarily time, in which different forces are dominant at different times. The sun, the rain, the moon, right? Different times, different forces are dominant. And you have to figure out how to survive among that, you know, within that. And there's no question about it that the forces of nature were completely disinterested in man. They had no relationship to man. Man had to assure his own survival by maneuvering within the forces as time carried man along. There's no question that the river is time, and Paro is out of the river, and the cows are out of the river. Now, what does that mean? First, let's talk about what is the implication of this faith, this fear. So I wouldn't say fear, this submission to time. Well, we have a word for it. The word for feeling that your fate is in the hands of powers greater than you, that carry you along, that you must acknowledge, and you must, you know, adjust your choices and understandings to ensure your survival, because they're greater and they're stronger, all of these forces. The word we have is fatalism, fate. Okay? Fatalism is the idea that man is helpless, you know, before the forces that are greater to them. And because man is helpless, there's a futility in man's will to influence these forces. It's ultimately futile. There's no point to try to have an influence or try to manage these forces because they're much stronger and they don't care. So ultimately, if there's a futility of human will and a total resignation in the face of these forces, it leads to helplessness. It leads to mankind accepting the future, not recognizing that they have no power to influence the future of the world or even their own actions. Where does this come from? This comes from an idea that is an ancient idea. Aristotle speaks about it, you know, and modern science, actually, with the Big Bang Theory, that was the ultimate death blow to this idea, believe it or not. It's called the static state theory. The world was always here. There was no point of beginning. The infinity of time, it was always existed. It's called the static state theory. There's actually people that believed in this theory till not long ago. The Big Bang asserted that there was a beginning, and it's obviously they're getting very close to the point of Boratius. Okay? But I remember when I was in high school, by the way, the man who discovered Penzias, Arno Penzias, his daughter was in Bruria with us in one grade above me, and it was a big, huge deal when he got a Nobel Prize for it. And anyway, but the point is, they believed in a static state theory, the infinity of time. That was a prevalent view. They had no tools to even think out of that construct. That is time, that is the river. But here Paro, way back in the ancient world, is getting a glimpse of the possibility that maybe that's not the only explanation of life. Now, you have the inevitability of time, and you have therefore mankind's hope, fate, you know, helplessness, not just in time, but the forces of nature that govern time. So what does man start to do? They know, as we said, two things. They're helpless, nature is stronger, and nature doesn't care. So all they try to do is appease, by great sacrifice, these forces, so that when these forces are dominant, or the gods are having their temper tantrums, or it's their moment to shine, they'll remember that down here are helpless, pathetic pawns who are going to suffer because of what goes on in there, and they should, because they've been bribed, take them into consideration and leave them alone a little bit. That was the extent of their worship, and a little bit of magic to try to see what they can do to, you know, manage a little bit. Okay, this is a terrible way to live. Everybody is a slave. Everybody is a victim. Everybody is a pawn. And this time goes on. Okay, now, in this fatalistic view, obviously, you are subject to forces, as we said, greater than you, and you cannot think outside of this. Let me give you an example how this is alive and well. 20 years ago, there was an article in Life magazine. There was a province in China, downriver from way downriver from an area that was a little bit more advanced. And there was no water flowing in the river, and all the people started to starve to death because they didn't have water. And they were starving, and people were dying, and And somehow it came to the light of some people in charge that this village was starving, and a few villages along the river were starving. So they sent somebody down to see what the story is, and the solution was the following. 20 miles upriver was a dam, and behind the dam was tons of water. But the intake valve, the pipe that took the water from one side of the dam to the other, was 3 or 4 inches above the water level. That was the problem. So they lowered the pipe. Okay, now, why didn't the people downriver figure it out? Because if they're starving, it's the will of the gods that they are starving, and who are they to interfere with the gods? And if they do try to interfere, their god's fury will be even, will rain down on them with even more strength. Total paralysis, okay? Now, what happens here? Paros is seeing, he's out, so he's above the river, and the cows are above the river. Now, what do the cows represent? So Rabbeinu Bachai, okay, says the following, and these are very important words. He says that they did not have a concept in those days, as we just said, okay, in the concept of Yediyah, that there is a God who knows what's going on, Hashgacha, that he's involved with what's going on, and Chiddush, that he can interfere with and manage things down here, that Kadosh Baruch Hu at will can change or interfere with the laws of nature. They believed, as we said, in the idea that they were removed from the gods. So, he says that the 7 here represents, to Paro, the 7 cows, not just what Yosef says is the dreams, but the 7 cows were the 7 mazolos, the kochve, they had certain constellations, 7 and 7, meaning they understood that in nature there were forces ultimately of life and prosperity and health and birth. Those were the good forces. And of course there was death and disease and destruction, and those were the bad forces. And there were 7 is teva, primary forces on each side, okay? Now, these primary forces of good and bad, which later, the next great paganistic empire after the Egyptians, were the Zoroastrians, who believed, again, that there was a god, a supreme god, who was very removed. And beneath that god were forces of darkness, trying to destroy all the good of that god, and forces of good, which were defending themselves against the black or darkness. So they basically divided up into 2 categories also, and then we'll speak about the Greeks. But basically, there were forces. Now, what allowed people to continue living under this arrangement? That although they were helpless in, underneath, below, weaker than the god, the good gods and the bad gods, from experience, it was clear that basically life went on. Basically, there was a predictability about the cycles of life, and they could basically survive. Now, every now and then, there was that random natural, catastrophe. There was that drought, or that tsunami, or that hurricane, or earthquake, or plague. And the forces of God obviously were, having a temper tantrum, or dominating, or whatever it was. And that was very painful, and very ugly for people. Very difficult to endure, but inevitably, at the end of all of that, they saw that, the good would ultimately reassert itself, life would go on, the hurricane would stop, the drought, there'd be rain, children would be born again, life would go on. There was a certain continuum, but into the continuum were always these unpredictable moments of catastrophe, the good gods and the bad gods, but basically there was a kind of balance between them. And that's the good, the beautiful cows and the ugly cows standing next to each other. Okay? And like I remember when I went to Italy, we went to see Mount Vesuvius. And I remember the hair cutter there, the nice guy, Sal. So he says, oh, you're going to Italy. It's right across from Supercell Seasons. So he says, you're going to Italy. You have to go visit my hometown, Herculia. Herculia, I said, where's Herculia? He goes, oh, it's at the foot of Vesuvius. It was buried under the lava 10 times. So I said, okay, Sal, I get the first time. I even get the second time. But the point is that there's a town there now, a big, huge city right at the foothills of Vesuvius. Anyway, the point is, and it's an active volcano. There's still smoke coming out of it. anyway, the point here is that life would continue, but now Paro sees something that he has, does not have the tools to deal with. What if, what? What if what? What is he afraid of? He's got the balance. Life will go on. There'll be those terrible moments, but things will be okay. But what does he see? What if the forces of destruction, Armageddon, how many movies are made about this? What if those forces of utter destruction somehow break free and their power is unleashed and the whole world, and man, we're concerned about man, is caught up in just this endless devastation, destruction, evil and pain and cruelty that just destroys everything around it. What of that? The same things people today are afraid of. This is a common theme in the media, okay? And what happens then? How do we control that? He's seeing that he's out of the river. He's not in the river. How do we control that possibility? How do we have any sense of determination of our fate? And here the Rabbeinu B'chai explains here, he doesn't understand that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is Mashkiach, watching, V'yochol, and capable of everything, and Mechadesh, and can manipulate nature, that nature doesn't have a life of its own. He's in terror. Yosef comes and says to him, Biladai, it's not me, Elokim Yane Eshalom Paro. If you understand one word, Elokim, peace of mind will be restored to you. We know what Elohim is. There's one chapter in Bereshit that exclusively uses the name Elohim for Hashem. And what parak is that?
First.
The first. And what is the first parak about? Teva, the Bria, the creation of the world. That's always seven, by the way. Nature is created in the first, described as being created in the first parak, and the name Elohim is used. Elohim is synonymous with the nature that Hashem created, which is Hashem's will, and which can really be a serve as a tool to demonstrate Hashem's mastery over the world. The concept of Elohim means that Hashem created all of nature. There are no competing forces. There are no forces that act in randomly. And they certainly do not have power to destroy the world that Hashem created. HaKadosh Baruch Hu's control is controlling all of these forces, and he uses them as he pleases in a way that is to the benefit of man. But this is just the beginning. This is the first lesson. There's a second lesson. Why did Hashem create nature? What is nature? Is it just a scientific mask so that we can have the intellectual thrill of unraveling the puzzle and finding out that it's really Hashem behind nature? What is the point of nature? Why did Hashem create nature and it's in the intense, the content of what is possible for us how we can use nature, I would say. The enormity of the potential in nature. Look what we've done once we discovered electricity. Look what we can do when we understand genetics. Look what we can do when we understand jet propulsion. Look what we can do when we understand nature. And we're just scraping the tip of the iceberg now, right? What is nature? So Rav Hirsch says it's called, the earth is called Adama. So what's Mitzrayimah? No, not from, careful.
Two
Mitzrayim, Artsa. So what's Adama? Le Adam, to man. Nature is at the disposal of man. Man is not a victim to forces of nature. So here's how it goes in a fatalistic mindset. Nature is going to bestow upon us years of plenty, so we're all going to prosper, and we're all going to get fat, and it's going to be wonderful. Then there is going to be a famine. What happens in a famine? We all starve to death. That's what's going to happen. That's the inevitable. We are helpless to change it. Therefore, we accept our fate, and we just try to hope, for the best, that it won't be as bad. And that's what it is. It is what it is. So there's fatalism takes a fact, a natural phenomenon, interprets it as the will of the gods, and therefore becomes completely helpless, completely paralyzed because of it. Here's what Yosef does. Yosef presents to Paro the possibility of this. all you're being told is that there's going to be years of plenty and years of drought. But you're outside of the river. You do not have to interpret it to mean that therefore you are going to be a victim of this. It's a fact. There's no interpretation in the fact. It's just a fact. God has not told you his will. He's just told you information about what is going to happen in the world, in the physical world. That's it. Now, if you know that HaKadosh Baruch Hu can put nature at our disposal so that we can use nature to enhance our life and bring us to appreciation of Hashem, then our interpretation as Jews is, this is the facts. How can we take advantage of it to the best of our ability so that we prosper and benefit from it? It's not a death sentence. It's not a verdict. It's nothing. It's just a fact. I propose we save up all the food in the good years so that we become the richest empire, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And in the end, it's going to be the greatest thing that ever happened to Egypt because man decided that. Because man decided that. You see, Yosef is not interfering with the will of Hashem. There is no stated will of Hashem here. It's just information. We are not fatalists. We take information, even about nature, and we say, now that we know it, what are we going to do with it to our benefit, to enhance man's position in this world, to help ourselves, to propel us further, and to help us become, in this case, very powerful and very mighty, which ultimately this power went to Klal Yisrael, this wealth. And they worked for it, true, and they deserved it. But in the end, buried, the Chazal say, buried under the shrine to Baal Tzafon was all this wealth of Egypt that Yosef had collected back in the day, which they took with them out of, you know, and they which drowned, which they found on the banks of the river after the Egyptians were drowned. So here Yosef is introducing a brand new concept. There is no such thing as fatalism. Man is not a pawn. Man is the center of the universe, not a peripheral little irrelevant side story. Man is the center. Man can use nature as he wills, provided it brings a greater understanding of Hashem in the world. That's what it's here for. We hold the keys to our destiny in our hands. This is clearly what the dream is about. They're out of the river. There are seven forces balanced, but then the evil overcomes him. He's terrified. And Yosef says, there's Elohim. And Elohim is the God of Teva. And Teva is for us. And this is so revolutionary. What this really is, if you want to know the truth, this is the beginning of Chayrus, of freedom. Not physical freedom, which the Jews as a nation experienced, actually walking out of the physical land of Egypt. This is intellectual freedom. This is emotional freedom. This is what you might call the beginning of science. The ability, the right, the permission to look at nature as objects that may be observed, their motions recorded and analyzed, conclusions made, and then through human ingenuity, determinations of how we can best use this to our advantage. Now, of course, Avraham started this. Remember the famous Medrash about how he looked at the sun and he saw the sun was covered by the clouds, so it couldn't be the sun. And then it went away at night, and the moon, and then the clouds. The moon is covered by clouds, but then the wind blew away the clouds. This is scientific observation. In the days of nature worship, if you had the chutzpah, the hubris, to look at one of the gods as if it was an object and record its motions, you were crazy. It would be infuriated with you. You were afraid to do that, obviously. But here, that's what Avram does, and that's what Yosef is telling them. This is really the beginning of the freedom to let man advance himself, the beginning of science, the beginning of freeing humanity from this gripping fear of forces greater than them who are unconcerned with them, a fatalistic fear. Now, let's talk about Egypt and Greece. How did the Egyptians back in the day depict their gods? And this transition that Yosef starts does not play itself out instantaneously. It's a very long process, but within 1,000 years, when time you get to the Greeks, like 800 years, by the time you get to the Greeks, it's gone. What happens? And the Zoroastrians are in the middle, the Persians, Iranians, but what happens? How? Go to the Met. You'll see in Google, Valley of the Queens. So you'll see how the Egyptians, we can't go there anymore, it's an archaeological site, but you'll see how the Egyptians depicted their gods. First of all, they were enormous, intimidating. And what were their bodies like? They were components of
animals.
What kind of animals?
Dogs.
What type of birds? Aggressive, ruthless predator birds. Falcon beaks, claws of a bear or a lion, wings of an eagle, cats, a lot of cats. In the Met, there are mummified cats and mummified alligators or crocodiles because they worshipped the crocodile. That's part of the Tzfardea business with the god. The crocodile was a god. Remember, Tzfardea was really some kind of crocodile, some type of version, I think, of the frog, reptile. And they depicted their gods as intimidating, aggressive, ruthless. They were completely in fear of them. And they certainly, these gods, as we said, had no interest in people. And ultimately, that's why they were fatalists. And that, of course, makes you cruel to everybody else around you, too. Believing in these type of forces means that you have the right to behave the same way. By the time you get to the Greeks, it's completely different. First of all, are their gods animals?
No.
They're human. Not only are they human, they're beautiful. And they're not remote. They're very accessible. First of all, not only are they accessible, they're very similar to people. They have the same vices. They wine and women and war, right? They have the same weaknesses. In fact, you could even outsmart them. You could outwit the gods, right? They have no fear of their gods. Their fear is in mythology, but it's not a practical living fear of the gods. What happened? Where did the fear go of nature being so intimidating and so unforgiving and so cruel to being beautiful and benign and slightly, and even, you know, kind of like, you know, sometimes blinded. And the gods themselves, you could get what you wanted despite the gods. They were not the source of what you wanted. You were the source of what you wanted. What happened there? So Edith Hamilton is a famous writer on Greek mythology. I can't find most of the best books that I had in my library. Edith Hamilton, my mythology book. God and the Astronomers by Jastrow, who writes about the static state theory and the Big Bang theory. And he was a Jew, Jastrow. And he's a very interesting book. I don't know if it's still in print, called God and the Astronomers. Fascinating book. He's a Nobel Prize winner also. And I think related maybe to our family because my grandfather's grandmother's name was Jastrow. And he thought there was some relation in that. But it's a very good book. You should Google it. God and the Astronomers, a very small book about physics, about the whole new shift in physics with the Big Bang. Very interesting. Anyway, in the book I used to have by Edith Hamilton, who writes this book on Greek mythology, which is like a textbook for many introductory courses in college, she speaks about the transition between the Egyptian god-like concept and the Greek concept. And she asks how this happened. And her brilliant solution is it's the mythological writers. They just conceived of a new notion. But that is not how it happened. It happened because the Jewish people came on the scene with Yosef and then with the Makos and the Beis HaMikdash and our ideology, which is there's no such thing as nature gods and you don't have to be afraid of them and you can do what you want. That's what happened. And that opened the door to, ultimately, this kind of nostalgic relationship to the gods, but not any more a sense of intimidation. And by the way, Aristotle, who's considered the father of science, who is the so-called first to be observing and recording the motions of the heavenly bodies, is about 1,500 years after Avraham, and much later than Yosef also. Okay? This is the shift to the Greeks. Now, it's not that the Greeks were no longer afraid of nature. Okay? It just shifted because the Greeks were not, you know, their ideology was not acceptable to ours. In fact, it was not acceptable, but there was potential in it to enhance our Torah and enhance our learning and understanding. Yaft Elokim liyefet, Hashem said back the bracha Noach gave to his children. V'yishkon ba'ahal leshem. Yefes is Greece. that beauty is bestowed upon them, beauty emotional, intellectual, physically, all of that beauty and the pursuit of beauty, but channeled into the tents of shame. Now, what is the beauty of Greece? Greece, this is Hanukkah, and I'll get back to the Hanukkah dreams. They did not believe the world at that point. Today, some Hindus still believe in it back in wherever. But they're not at all important in terms of influence. Anyone, by the way, who believes in nature worship has had zero impact in the advancement of the world. Zero. They have absolutely no influence in the advancement of the world because they can't have any influence because they don't advance. They go round and round in circles in their river, and it's called cyclical time, the river of time that just keeps them surviving through the cycles again and again and again and again. And Thomas Cahill, who wrote a book called The Gifts of the Jews, speaks about the idea that in the ancient world, even the words of future, destiny, goal, purpose did not exist in the mindset. There was no such thing of extricating from the cycle of time and going forward, which is what Yosef's telling them to do. Go forward. This is an opportunity for the future, right? There is no such thing. So the Greeks are not, as we said, they are not victims to the forces of nature. But what they've done is they've asserted their...